I got the idea of asking Mike if I could give this talk because about 3 weeks ago, I bumped into our young Bertrand Russell, Chris Moore, and we were talking, I said something about Charles Peirce, and he said, "Who dat?" And I thought, God, this younger generation, that's... I am by no stretch of the imagination a Peirce expert. I'm an amateur, but I've been noodling around to learn more about this figure, and I'll tell you more about it in a second, for the last couple of years. And I wanted to... there was a talk here at the Institute about 3 years ago or so, some woman who was a faculty member at Penn State came here and essentially read a paper, and I don't remember anything about it, and I don't think I understood or got very much out of it. And I remember my frustration of trying to figure out who is this guy that she's talking about. So now I know something about it, and I'd like to share this with you. And indirectly, I want to say that what we call science is really a 19th century invention. I mean, its antecedents go way, way, way back, and, you know, when Galileo understood mathematics being a language of nature and so forth. But the concept of a research enterprise using an increasingly well-defined set of methodologies and developing experimental techniques, this was really the 19th century, and it was largely Europe, and it was England, Germany, and France really created our modernish view of science, and that's the world that Peirce was really deeply involved with. And this thing we call science has always been under attack. And it always will be under attack. I mean, it was under attack for millennia by religion. It's under attack today by every horoscope column and spoon-bending thing that you see around. And today, for the first time in recollection almost, it's under attack on theoretical grounds. And if you read Paul Feyerabend, the late Feyerabend of University of California, Berkeley, he outlines the situation where science, as we know it, is accused of being a privileged point of view, and that it is the usual culprits. It's, you know, the dead white European males and the current living white males, and that it's a privileged point of view, and it's intended to maintain hegemony by its practitioners and to reject alternative, you know, points of view, whether they are mystic... Okay, but wait. And so it's under attack for the first time as a theory of attack now. And I stand for the view that science is a privileged point of view, and it is so on epistemological grounds. And when you examine the question that way, you will find that one of the great heroes of that statement is Charles Peirce. Now, one of the, and I'm going to come to this in a moment, but what Peirce called semiosis, it's the action of signs, the action of representations, the dynamics of representations, and their emergent semantic properties, which is really what he was thinking about all the time. This came out of his experiences in science. And the way I got interested in him was through a long-standing interest in the subject of memes. You know, when I read Chapter 7 in Dawkins' Selfish Gene, the idea of a replicating mental unit, cultural unit, informational unit, that is kind of a disembodied unit, seemed to me to have extraordinary explanatory power potentially, and it intuitively felt very, very satisfying. But it had a real problem, because if you look at it seriously, you know, from a scientific point of view, you hang up on the fact that you can't get your arms around the idea of this replicating unit. What is it? And how do you measure it? How do you scale it? And that's really been a problem. And And it was one of these things that is what you could call a good word model. You know, it was an attractive word model, but it lacked the formalism. And because it lacked the formalism, that's, you know, it would just remain an attractive idea, but you couldn't really do very much with it. And so in the process of thinking about that set of issues, I went back to read some things again that I had read many years earlier, having to do with the theory of signs in semiotics, which I at that time associated with a European school of linguistics, semiotics, the theory of signs. So I thought, well, maybe there's a formalism buried someplace in all these theories of semiosis and sign action, and maybe that's where one ought to look. And to this date, by the way, I have never encountered anybody who's ever tried to examine those two sort of concepts together, memes and signs. Potentially, you know, a rich idea, I think. But in any case, so I was reading around in semiosis, semiotics, and wherever you'd go, you'd bump into the name Charles Sanders Peirce. And I started to say before that the pronunciation of his name, or the conventional mispronunciation of his name, I'll bet that some of you are always just slightly jarred when you hear me say Peirce rather than Pierce. We've seen the spelling a lot. He spells it P-E-I, and the other folks spell it P-I-E. Well, this is the most beautiful self-reflexive case of semiosis. You know, it's just right on the dime. You know, this is signs showing, you know, their actions behaviorally. And for Peirce, semiosis was not only a metaphysical concept, but it was a biological and physical one. This whole area of the study of signs, probably its earliest practical meaning was in the time of Galen and the Greeks. It was a medical diagnosis. You looked for the signs of illness. So sign interpretation was already there at some practical level. Today we have what I always have thought of as very interesting, and Carl Gerassi really could tell you a lot about this, is semiochemistry. It's the chemistry of signs, and you know, the insect pheromone area is very well characterized. And there's a guy named Howard Patti. You should have him out here because he's interested in how a molecule becomes a message. You know, how you start to get emergent semantic properties from molecules. That's quite interesting. By the way, Peirce had a graduate degree in chemistry, and his father always thought that that was his missed career, that he should have been a chemist. And he was a summa cum laude when he got his he got a BS from the Lowell Institute at Harvard in chemistry. Semiotics is a fairly well-known subject. The linguists know it, a lot of philosophers know it, anthropologists relate it to, you know, structuralist theories. It's Peirce alone who really gave the idea of action, of kinetics of signs, that signs, there are whole taxonomies of them, signs which were what he called indexical signs, which pointed at something, signs which were sort of naked representations, signs which were symbols. He had a fairly evolved taxonomy of signs, and his work is of great system building. He spoke of speculative grammars. He insisted on that logic was three-valued. And he was, you know, he was the greatest logician America produced, sans doute, as you'll see. And he was always working on what he called the logic of relatives, the calculus of indications, the algebra of relations. He was an absolute fanatic about George Boole, who he just thought was the greatest. Now, until I started in on Peirce a few years ago, I didn't really know much about him. I knew his name in association with this philosophical movement called pragmatism. I knew that he was a buddy somehow of William James, but I had never read anything of his. Even though I read lots of philosophy as an undergraduate at the University of Chicago in the 1940s, I never read Peirce. I read a little Dewey, but I never read any Peirce. And I knew that James was always felt indebted to him. Well, I also realized when I started in a couple of years ago that there was hardly anything of Peirce's in print. The only thing I knew of was a Dover, now it's been reprinted, of a little anthology of papers that they put together called Values. It's a very revealing title. It's an editor's title of Peirce's thought. It's called Values in a Universe of Chance. Chance was a deep concept for Peirce. But there was nothing, hardly anything in print. And then I learned further that he never wrote a book. He wrote thousands of book reviews, journal articles, scientific publications, monographs, brochures, you name it. He never wrote a book. He planned about 20 of them. He presented outlines to people of them, but he never wrote one. In his lifetime, there were about 12,000 pages of his work in print in his lifetime. He left, however, 80,000 pages in manuscript form, of which about 2,500 have been reprinted so far. So there's God knows what out there. There's a recent, I just saw it in a bookstore back east the other week, of 4 volumes on the mathematics of Peirce. He was trying to develop curricula for arithmetic for kindergartners. He was all over the joint. He was a real polymath. And by the way, to its eternal shame, Harvard University will always bear this badge of shame. They suppressed Peirce's papers. The ostensible reason is that they felt that they were damaging to Peirce's reputation. You'll get this in a moment. And this is a story that has a couple of real villains in it. One of them is President Charles Eliot of Harvard, who had an animus against Peirce because he was this great man's son. And when Eliot had him as a freshman at Harvard, Peirce was engraving his initials in the bench, and they had a row, and Peirce was always snotty. And then, this pervaded his life, and Eliot, from his position at the presidency of Harvard, destroyed Peirce, as you'll see. Now, I'm not suggesting everybody rush out and read him. He's history. He's pointing out something. He's anticipating some things, as you'll recognize, but I don't know that he has that much relevance for the challenges of science today. He's an ancestral figure, and he's got great anticipatory power, which is what I feel when I look at him. Now, a point I'd like to emphasize is that Peirce's development of semiotic theory is a direct and fundamental outgrowth of his career in science. This is not a philosopher dabbling about science. This is a working scientist, and you'll see his accomplishments in a moment, because he not only was a scientist, thought of himself that way for the first half of his life at any rate, but he had a deep knowledge and love of science. He studied scientific history and scientific figures incessantly, and he had a lifelong fascination with the whole subject, more than fascination, it was central to his architectonic, is that there was the methods of science and science philosophy. And he was not a dabbler. I think anybody who encounters him will see that he's a very prescient figure. I think he anticipates many directions. Prigogine, really an enthusiast of Peirce's, says that he had uncanny views of time, the second law of thermodynamics, chaos, sensitive dependence, and self-organization of large-scale uniform effects. And he seems to anticipate much modern physical theory. I picked out this 2 or 3 sentences out of Peirce. I'm not going to read any Peirce to you except this one little bit. He says, and mind you, he's generally backing this kind of stuff up with formula and equations and so forth. Force is in the long run dissipative. Chance is in the long run concentrative. The dissipation of energy by the regular laws of nature is by those very laws accompanied by circumstances more and more favorable to its reconcentration by chance. There must therefore be a point at which the two tendencies are balanced, and that it is no doubt the actual condition of the universe at the present time. And he would be the first one to tell you that it's much easier to talk philosophy to scientists than it is to talk science to philosophers. I don't know. You'll have to explore. I mean, I think, look, I could give you some, you know, suggestive guesses, but that's not the point of this talk today. I haven't gotten to his life yet. I'm going to get to that in a moment. Because Harvard suppressed his personal archives, the biographical material on him was always in short supply. You look at him in Encyclopedia Britannica. You try to figure out, you know, who is this guy, Pierce? You get this little sketchy thing, and there's one thing that jumps out at you if you're sort of in tune and with this issue, is there seems to be an absence of an academic connection. You'd expect this guy to be at universities. You'd expect him to be at Harvard, actually. But it's not there. And then there's, you know, a suggestion that there's something embarrassing here. And so there wasn't much biographical material about him. And attempts that I was making to read him directly, to get the few things that were in print, were also slightly frustrating because his terminology always seems obscure. And you're never quite sure what he's talking about, but it's intuitively, you feel you've got it. And he was very aware of this problem. And he said that it takes a little bit of time to master it. His style was subject of a multi-page discussion in Ogden and Richards' Meaning of Meaning, by the way, and it was a formidable style. By the way, Kant was his greatest look up to. You know, that was, you know, and he took over Kant's literary style. He had a very Germanic style, and one of his first earliest great works was this theory of new categories, which is really a kind of homage to Kant, and he's expanding those categories. Peirce always apologized for his prose, although he was probably one of the most prolific writers of the 19th century, and he wrote in popular journals, you know, all the time. But he always blamed it on the fact that he was left-handed. He just said, "I'm obscure," and it's his left-handedness, which was very strongly marked. And he knew of the discovery of Broca's area in the brain and believed that he had some lesion there, so that he couldn't express his thoughts clearly. Of course, he was dealing with one of the most complicated and advanced subjects, and nobody understood what he was talking about at all. Nobody had a clue as to what he was talking about in those days. Add to this the fact that because he was in really virgin territory, he had this incredible habit of neologizing. He'd make up these terms, these with Greek roots, and you know, you had to. You know, it was just a little hurdle to get over to get into his work, and it's not very rewarding in that sense. I mean, you know, read it quickly, I think, unless you're a Peirce specialist. By the way, there's a Peirce list server that I've been lurking on for the last 2 years, also, which, you know, just really for the fanatics. And then all of this was wrapped up in a kind of 19th century style that seems clumsy to us today because it had all these ornate, you know, dependent clauses and nested clauses. And, you know, we got a very streamlined Rush Limbaugh, you know, Hollywood type of language today. And so for that reason, it's also. And this reminds me of the fact that we're only 14 generations from Chaucer, but if Chaucer were in the room, he would not understand anything I was saying remotely. And if he was trying to talk, we couldn't understand anything that he was saying. Only 14 generations. Just think about that. It's like, you know, George Washington's hammer at Mount Vernon. They, you know, the tour director said that they've, you know, it's in great shape. They've only changed the head twice and the handle three times. As Washington, you know. So, you know, when you read 19th century, you know, language, sometimes it's, anyway. So, finally, about 2 years ago, Joseph Brent's biography came out, and what I'm about to tell you is really just, you know, shrink version of Brent's biography. This was a 1960 PhD thesis in the history department at UCLA, which got rescued by the Peirce fanatics. There are them, reprinted by University of Indiana Press. The two great centers in America, there are several in Europe, but the two great centers in America for Peirce studies are University of Indiana, you know, in advanced linguistics, basically, and semiotics, and Texas Tech University, which bought the entire archive from Harvard because Harvard, you know, what could they do? There were these four remaining boxes of, it's like the Freud archive has problems of this kind too, that, you know, won't see the light for another 20 years yet. But anyway, so Texas Tech, Lubbock is the other great center of it now. Biographies of scientists are revealing. Biographies of artists are much more revealing. But biographies of philosophers are really transparent. I mean, because that's what you're seeing. And I have a weakness for them. So when I saw Brent's biography advertised, I, you know, had it FedExed, and I read through it very quickly. Now, so how am I going to tell you about his actual life? Okay. Come in on him as a snapshot in the early 1880s. He's in his early 40s, and he's at the high point of his life. So he lived to be 75 years old. He died in utter, abject, miserable poverty in Milford, Pennsylvania, in 1914. This was what was called the Gilded Age. If any of you saw this movie, The Age of Innocence, you know, or read Edith Wharton's book, you see it was an age of, it was such humbug and hypocrisy, and, you know, I mean, it was worldwide, and, you know, and America was aping England, and it was just, you know, it was just looking at it today, we just have to wonder. But it was, you know, culture is very strong. And the last half of the 19th century was kind of unbridled capitalism. The Federal Reserve Bank wasn't created until 1914. It was just rolling robber barons, and, you know, the energy in the system was enormous. Great deal of turbulence. Marx was getting bigger and bigger. It was an age of political machines. And anyway, if you look at the world's universities at that period, the second half of the 18th century, biological science, medicine was, you know, studied at Padua in the 14th century already. But there wasn't really an enterprise called modern science. That was born in that last half of that century. And it was, there were a number of things that really triggered it. There was the Franco-Prussian War ended in 1870, so armaments, techniques of metallurgy. I mean, now sophistication began to enter in the Industrial Revolution. I mean, you've pointed out about, you know, some of this and some of the things you've talked about. But it was developing a critical mass. It was networking at some unprecedented level. And German universities finally made the connection between advanced research in small groups and connecting it with the awarding of doctoral degrees. That was, you know, before you had doctoral degrees in theology, divinity, the old version of what was called science, natural philosophy. But the Germans really created a model, and the English were, at Oxford and Cambridge, were chasing them in another kind of way. And it wasn't until the founding of Johns Hopkins University in 1876 that, you know, there was a true American research university on the European lines. And the Harvards of the world were still half theological schools in those days. And it was at a time when engineering technologies were really changing the world. I just did a quick list in one of these coffee table books that I saw. By the way, you know the story of, you know, Lynn White's story of the stirrup, because the ability to hit somebody with the full impact of the horse added to your body was of such an advantage that, according to him, this created feudalism, because now you needed guys on horses, and that meant attendance, and it meant fields of hay. And that's the basis of feudalism. So when you look at the churning effect of engineering on the world in this part of the century, here you had Westinghouse develop the railroad air brake, Alexander Graham Bell the telephone, Edison the light bulb, and the phonograph, Ingersoll the rock drill, Eastman the photographic paper, Suez Canal was underway, patent laws were being extended to the chemical industry in Germany, so forth, electric transmission becoming common. And these engineering developments were driving curiosity about science at more basic levels. And that we started to get Maxwell's theory on electricity and magnetism, Clausius's contribution to the second law of thermodynamics, Mendeleev's periodic table. They discovered new elements, Kekulé's realization of the benzene ring. Rutherford is looking at radioactivity, Doppler on wave compression, Boltzmann on the kinetic theory of gases, Kelvin working on the size of atoms, etc. You'll notice there wasn't an American name in the bunch. Well, but research worldwide was reaching some kind of critical mass. And on the biological side, Pasteur, Helmholtz was looking at the nerve impulse at that time. They were discovering the properties of anesthesia. They were discovering that you could stain bacteria and look at them under a microscope. The first Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon discoveries were coming out. Schliemann was excavating Troy. What's that line of Wordsworth? It's at that very dawn to be alive. It was an amazing period. That's right. But that was about the French Revolution, isn't it? I think it is, yeah. The important thing I'm making the point is that it was a European activity in those days, and American science barely existed. MIT was essentially the land-grant college specializing. It was, A&M. It was agricultural and mechanical. And it had not yet become what it became. This was one of the reasons that Charlie Peirce was a transatlantic traveler all of his life. He probably spent three, four years of his life, of his mature life, in Europe, visiting scientists. One final and essential background point before we meet him in person, and that is it's an essential, really essential to understanding of his life. And some of this I'm getting between the lines, I admit, but I'm certain of it. There is this, what the Japanese call the floating world. The French call it the demi-monde. It's the world of bohemians and actors and prostitutes and pamphleteers and revolutionaries and anarchists, and writers and painters. Okay, the floating world. And in those days, and certainly for almost a century, it was Paris-based. And Peirce spent an immense amount of time in Paris. It was, full of dandies, drug users, and he was going to shows of Degas and Lautrec and Renoir and listening to Brahms and Wagner and saw the opening of Carmen by Bizet. And it was a world that was really assaulting the ramparts of bourgeois hypocrisy from a completely different direction than science was. And it was it was having a good time, that world, while it was doing that. And Charlie Peirce's membership in that world caused a fatal damage to his life's career. And it's really one of the interesting stories. It would be an enormous mistake to think of Peirce the way I used to think of him, as some grave philosopher like Immanuel Kant, This was a maverick. This was a heterodox gay blade. This was a bohemian. And, he was really something. And he was really an irregular. But from that element in him, he died an impoverished outcast. Okay, so it's the early 1880s. He's in his early 40s. The photographs of him show him as an exceptionally handsome guy. There's one that is the frontispiece of the biography, which is at the Congress of Berlin in 1875. He's got top hat, he's got, foulard, he's got tails, his spats, and a cane. And he always would spend outrageously on clothes. He had no sense of financial discipline. He just was broke all the time, and he spent all the time. When he was in Paris, he hired a sommelier for 2 years to teach him about wines. Honestly. Well, anyway, and he's very energetic, and he's very well connected. Because of his father, and I'll come to him in a moment, he's exceptionally well known. And in Europe, he's probably regarded as the best-known figure in American science. There's nobody even close to Charles Peirce. He's the only one who understands what we are doing here. And the fact that he travels to all of these places, I'm sure all of you know what it's like. You go to a half a dozen places, and you get another point of view. And certainly nobody in Europe thought of him as a philosopher. And Paris, the 1870s, the first time he's there, the Paris Commune has just been suppressed by the military. There are 30,000 cafes and cabarets in Paris at that time. And everybody is drinking absinthe, which has prohibited oil of wormwood rotting their brains, and the French have just conquered North Africa, and hashish is everywhere, and Charles Baudelaire has published Les Fleurs du Mal, making this, you know, the way to live, folks. It's a wild time to be alive, and there's Charlie Peirce, who speaks French. He's very well connected. Henry Cabot Lodge the first was a cousin of his, and he's representing American science, and he's a prodigy. And now, this is really the place to tell you a little bit about Charlie and drugs, which is inescapable if you look at what, I mean, in fact, the Brent biography, you know, says this in so many words. First of all, during his youth, when he was a student at Harvard, you got to remember that ether binges were considered entertainments, and nitrous oxide was used as a recreational gas rather than having anything to do with anesthesia. It's when somebody fell down, cracked their skull, and laughed while they were sewing him up that they realized, gee, it's also an anesthetic. And so when Charlie was growing up, this was the vogue among these guys in Cambridge. And of course, when William James wrote The Varieties of Religious Experience, this is exactly what he was referring to, these gas effects. And then Charlie and his father apparently had something called facial neuralgia, and probably some virally caused neuralgia in those days, but laudanum, tincture of opium, was commonplace. And half of Boston, you get the sense, was just, particularly the women, were just, opium addicts. There's no two ways about it. And then cocaine had stirred considerable medical interest, was easily available, and Charlie's contemporaries, get this, who were testimonial users of cocaine, included Thomas Edison, Ulysses Grant, Henrik Ibsen, Emile Zola, Jules Verne, Pope Leo XIII, Sigmund Freud, and Edward the Prince of Wales. There's apparently considerable evidence that, the drugs affected his personality. I mean, he was crashing, he would go, he actually had paralysis at a couple of times, and if you think, why would he have paralysis? You think he's completely OD'd on something, and probably several things at once. And cocaine use seems to have amplified a very arrogant and waspish behavior. I mean, he did not tolerate fools at all, and he made many enemies, and he used to have these periodic nervous collapses. And while he was working on the algebra of logic, he was under some sort of treatment for possible insanity, and I'm certain that this was, again, drug-related. So, in short, he was, as President Eliot of Harvard said, he was not a safe man. And he was a notorious figure. So in the U.S., he wasn't that well known. He was only known as a lecturer in logic, which was still a new subject. But in Europe, he had a formidable reputation as a scientist. For example, in astronomy, he started doing mathematical computations in theoretical astronomy for the Harvard Observatory. Over a 17-year period between 1861 and 1878, he came out with a steady stream of publications related to stellar and solar phenomena. He worked to standardize the relative magnitudes of stars. His monograph, Photometric Researches, was the first star catalog containing calculated magnitudes. He attempted to show that the Milky Way galactic cluster took the form of a disk, the first one. This was hands-on observational science he was doing, yet he couldn't resist doing important work on a theory of errors at the same time. He was the first user of the Harvard spectroscope, and he immediately pioneered the application of spectroscopy to determine the length of the meter in terms of a wavelength of light. It was absolutely new. In time, he became America's greatest expert on weights and measures and is the spiritual godfather of the Bureau of Standards. In geodesy, this was before there were satellites, of course, the measurement of the curved surface of the Earth was a major field of mathematical analysis, and Peirce made major contributions to the whole science of the topology of map projections. There are maps around that were, famous maps, which were Peirce maps. In gravity studies, which was really almost one of his specialties, he exploded this is what made him internationally famous in Europe, I think. At a very early age, he exploded the assumed reliability of, I think it was the Bessel pendulum, of pendulum measurements of gravity, by demonstrating that the flexure of the stands would put so much noise into the background that, you know, you had to throw out a lot of data. And then later he thought, you know, maybe we should use the wavelength of light to measure the length of the pendulum, too, while we're at it. So, he was singled out for praise at the conference of the International Geodetic Association meeting in Stuttgart in 1877. This was the first triumph of an American scientist in Europe. At the same meeting, he proposed that the wavelength of sodium light be used to measure the length of pendulums more accurately, and apparently Michelson and Morley built on Peirce's data. At the 1883 meeting of the International Geodetic Association in Rome, which he also attended, he was lionized for his work on gravity. In the area of logic, he knew everybody. When he was old, he was writing reviews of Bertrand Russell. He knew Frege's stuff. He knew all the British logicians, because that was the homeland for him. And all the Scottish philosophers, and Duns Scotus. He really went into the antecedents of British logic. And logic was his greatest passion. That's what his lifelong ambition was, to get a professorship of logic, you know? He'd been published by the National Academy of Sciences. He was a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He was a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which published his monographs. His works were reprinted in Europe in several languages. Stanley Jevons, the British logician, and John Venn, in Nature and in Mind respectively, hailed Peirce as like one of the great geniuses of the day, particularly for his contributions to Boolean and symbolic logic. And his theory of abductive or hypothetical logic, one of his real great contributions, really a theory of guessing, of how do you frame, what's good hypothesis framing, that was a really singular innovation. And I remember about a year and a half ago, I dragged Attlee to a lecture at St. John's that somebody was giving on Peirce, because I thought, he's doing all of this stuff and it's all based on this, inductive, deductive, and, there seems to me there's this gaping hole of, but he didn't, so we went to that. I don't know whether that seat took root. Anyway, by the time he was in his early 40s, he had produced 26 publications in logic, including a few which is some people think changed the course of philosophy. He was also the senior contributor and editor to the Century Dictionary, which was like a little encyclopedia in those days, and he was responsible for all words relating to science, philosophy, logic, mathematics, universities, so forth. He was a member of the London Mathematical Society. He was very well acquainted with Georg Cantor, with whom he had correspondence, of a personal nature. Hosea Royce was his greatest logic disciple. James, of course, Stanley Hall, the psychologist. Albert Bierstadt, the painter, was his great buddy of his. Poincaré, Dedekind, Ernst Schroeder. He visited with Maxwell at the Cavendish Laboratory. He believed scientifically in logical socialism, that science was a community enterprise, and it just, okay. Final truth never revealed. He grew up in a household where visitors, his father will come to in a moment, his visitors were Emerson, Lowell, Longfellow, Holmes, George Eliot, Horace Mann, William Dean Howells, Daniel Webster, Margaret Fuller, Superintendent Bache of the Coast Survey was there all the time, Joseph Henry of the Smithsonian was there all the time. It was Toot Harvard. He knew and studied. He was a prodigy from an early age. He studied Greek, Latin, modern languages. He knew all the classics. He was passionate about John Stuart Mill, Boole, as I said, Frege, Riemann, Hamilton, Planck, Russell, Darwin, Lombroso, Galton, von Liebig. Von Liebig was very important for him in chemistry. And he, in his later life, on behalf of the Smithsonian, he translated important European language articles into English. Anyway, within 10 years of this period, he was a recluse stealing food to survive, living at the edge of starvation. Like Oscar Wilde, I think he was the victim of an unremitting bourgeois hypocrisy, and which was compounded by a lot of petty vendettas against him. So, and the two leading villains of this story is one, as I told you, President Charles Eliot of Harvard, and the other was an observational astronomer named Simon Newcomb. And if you go to the National Academy, you'll see oil paintings of Newcomb, and he's got a fur collar with, just an incredible guy. And Harvard actually descended to the point of refusing to allow him to give visiting lectures on the campus. He had to lecture in private rooms arranged by James. And At the height of his career, things started to fall apart when two things occurred. One is his father died, and his father was his real protector. And then he got involved with a woman named Juliette Portaloy, a very interesting, mysterious figure. In contemporary materials at that time, he's described as brilliant, rakish, impulsive, quick-tempered, hot-headed, perverse, arrogant, sharp-tongued, emotional, easily duped, snobbish, indifferent of consequences, luxury-loving, risk-taking, dandified, a prickly sense of personal honor, suspicious of the motives of others. Every personal and professional disagreement in which he was involved came to a disagreeable end. And yet, extremely sweet and warm and tender to those who were close to him, such as William James or his second wife, Juliette. He was born in 1839, so the same year as Cézanne, Thomas Edison, and John D. Rockefeller. And his family was a Protestant, WASPy, Brahmin family, Unitarians. In the household environment, transcendentalism, abolitionism, Peirce family was prominent socially, politically, and intellectually. Charles's grandfather was the librarian of Harvard University. And Charlie was mathematically precocious, and the greatest passion of his life was the study of logic. The reasons he was such a prodigy, and here you think of John Stuart Mill, his father was, he was one of four children, boys, one Ben committed suicide, one became an ambassador in the Foreign Service, one became dean of the Graduate School of Harvard and professor of mathematics, and then there was Charlie and his father, Benjamin Peirce, America's most famous mathematician. As I said to you at before, there were three superstars at Harvard in those days. One was Benjamin Peirce as a mathematician. The second was Asa Gray, the botanist, and the third was Louis Agassiz, the paleontologist. These were the three superstars of Harvard. And I mean, it's like, you know, Stephen Jay Gould or Weinberg or somebody like that, you know, big deal. And and his father was you know, really was convinced that young Charlie had something, and he was gonna spare nothing. He was a very friendly, caring man. He had Agassiz and all of his buddies there. They were in the house all the time, and Charlie was sort of endowed as the star. And his father was, by the way, instrumental in getting Abbot Lawrence to endow a science school at Harvard. Benjamin Peirce was also the president of the AAAS. And with Agassiz, he was a founder of the National Academy of Sciences. And while he was a professor of mathematics, he was also the superintendent of the United States Coast and Geodetic Survey. And he was apparently an extremely successful salesman to Congress in getting appropriations. And his two major books, one of which we may have had, is one was called Analytic Mechanics, and the other was the Linear Associative Algebra. And he had several sons, as I said. Well, Charlie was started as a chess prodigy. He started chemistry at the age of 8, and at which time he read von Liebig, and and a description of what the experimental method of chemistry was. And he had his own home laboratory, and he worked his way through von Liebig's program of quantitative analysis. And at the age of 11, he wrote A History of Chemistry. At age 16, he began his lifelong study of Immanuel Kant. Of course, he went to Harvard, and then he got a BA at the age 19. He went another year at the Lowell Institute and got a master's degree in chemistry. Then he went back to Harvard and got one of the first BSs in chemistry, summa cum laude. And this is when he was fined when he was an undergraduate by Eliot for cutting his initials in a bench. And, you know, maybe Eliot was then an instructor. He wasn't yet the president. And he was a professor, I guess. Anyway, he took courses from Louis Agassiz, and he was appointed an assistant of the Coast Survey, and he went to Louisiana, Mississippi, and Maine. But logic was his real passion, and you know, which led him to the idea that all thoughts are signs. His widespread interest: he studied fossil classification under Agassiz, and when Darwin's Origin of Species appeared, the Agassiz experience put Peirce right at the center of intellectual debate in Cambridge. And he is on record for saying that Darwin's theory of irreversible biological evolution represented the greatest mental awakening since Newton and Leibniz. The very first job he had in his life was what was then called a computer. You know, a computer was a guy who computed. And he was a computer at the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Service. His father was very influential there, but not yet the superintendent. And his early work was to compare the longitudes of the American survey points with the European ones. And by the way, he had a 30-year-ish career with the survey, the Coast and Geodetic Survey. While there at the survey, he was assigned to the Harvard College Observatory. And while there, he wrote his first papers on the occultation of the Pleiades by the moon. When he was 23, he married Melusina Fay, Zena Fay, who was 3 years older than him, an old, similar type family. Her father had gone to, was a school classmate of Charlie's father. They'd known one another for years. They got married. She was a very strong-willed woman. She was became a very prominent feminist later. She wrote novels, and they had a very rocky marriage, no children. He never had any in his life. And and she was one of the founders of Radcliffe College. At 25, when he was 25 years old in Cambridge at Harvard, Eliot was not yet able to block him at that point. He gave a lecture series on the logic of science at Harvard's Lowell School. At the age of 28, he was elected a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the National Academy. In 1867, he writes his new list of categories, one of his great contributions to philosophy, fundamental starting point for his thought, and in it he outlines his theory of representations, his theory of signs, and also develops his idea of abductive logic for the first time. And then he does a second series of lectures at Harvard on British logicians. But he begins to get a little irritable. Why aren't they asking me to teach here? And he's hoping for a professorship somewhere, ideally in logic. He thinks it's his due. But by the time he's 30, he realizes that academic employment is not going to come his way. He turns down... Fortunately, his father was then named superintendent of the survey, even though he stayed on as professor of math at Harvard. And this institution was, for the next many, many years, Charlie Peirce's only source of employment. His father wanted him to pursue a career in chemistry, but he didn't want to do it. He wanted to stick with logic. In 1869, Charlie was sort of vetted over to the Harvard Observatory. He was one of the first human beings to look at the spectrum of argon, which he caught during an auroral display, and he measured the wavelength of its most characteristic line. He went to Sicily in 1870 to study the solar eclipse, and then he did a grand tour through Europe meeting scientists everywhere he went. Greece, Spain, Sicily, Naples, Rome, Florence, Venice, Munich, Vienna, Prague, Dresden, Berlin, London. In England, he visited Oxford and Cambridge. He met with the logician Stanley Jevons and Augustus De Morgan and demonstrated his attempt to expand Boole's algebra of logic to include the logic of relations. He apparently made a strong impression on everybody who met him. However, whilst he was away, President Eliot, who had a lifelong animus against him and now had become the president of Harvard, decided that Charlie was not going to get his salary from the observatory while he was in Europe. And then he decided further that he was going to cancel a scheduled course of lectures that Charlie was to give at the college. Charlie was really pissed off at this, and he decided not to go back to the observatory anymore, but to take a permanent position with the Coast Survey, on which he had only been sort of part-time involved. And this was his only employment for the next 20 years. But he continued to write a lot of reviews, sort of getting paid by the word. In 1871, he took up his serious work of measuring gravity, and he was the leading American scientist on the subject of gravity. He was attempting to get an accurate picture of the shape of the planet by doing pendulum researches. The drudgery kept killing him. He didn't have a budget for assistance, and he didn't have a computer of his own, so he had to do his own computing. And he started to find that this was so much drudgery that his flight to logic and philosophy was really where he wanted to be. And he was also not a very tactful guy. He always had protection from his father. And he traveled frequently apart from his wife, who he left in Cambridge, and apparently was just a womanizer all over the place. Great-looking guy, well-connected, you know. And then in 1872, his father named him the acting assistant in charge of the Washington office of the Coast Survey. The regular guy, Hilgard, remember the name, was in Europe. And, you know, there was interfacing with Washington, was the sleepy town then. So he sent young Charlie down there on a senior-like position. And this immediately raised cries of nepotism and, you know, made him some more enemies. and because people with greater seniority didn't get it. But anyway, he moved to Washington. He still had his work to finish at the Harvard Observatory. And this work at the Harvard Observatory, there's a fellow named, there's another element in the story, Winlock was the director of the observatory, and Charlie had some work he was to finish. And Winlock agreed to pay him $1,200 to finish it. And so Charlie went to work, and he went to Europe, and, you know, it was whenever you finish it, you get the $1,200. He came back and finished it, and Winlock had died and had never told Eliot about this. And Eliot said, out of the question, you're not getting it. And wouldn't believe Charlie. Later, it was there were some paper. But at that time, he, you know, and that was just increased the bitterness between them. And they were always jabbing at one another all their life long. And then finally, his father retired from the Coast Survey, but his father's protege, a guy named Patterson, took over. And this fellow, Hilgard, who was then running the Washington office and was traveling in Europe then, didn't get the appointment. And he was really annoyed that Benjamin Peirce didn't give it to him, that he gave it to this other guy, Patterson. But he stayed on as the number two guy. And this fellow was a drunk, a time server. I mean, he was a nowhere. Anyway, in 1874, Charlie went to Europe again, this time to bring the American science of geodesy up to European scientific standards. He visited physicists and instrument makers all over Europe. He saw Maxwell at Cambridge again. He went to Hamburg, Berlin, Geneva, all on gravimetric research. He was one of the few Americans who participated in the International Scientific Associations of Europe, but mostly he was based in Paris and enjoyed his life there in the demi-monde. Paris influenced him deeply. He's described sometimes as and Henry James writes to William that, you know, I'm hanging out with Charlie Peirce here. And meanwhile, he's working on pendulum stand flexure and a theory of errors. Something starts to go wrong during that period. I'm just guessing he's having he's drinking too much absinthe, something. Now, for the first time in his life, instruments turning up broken, pieces missing, garbage impediments. But somehow, Charlie's now beginning to get trapped a little bit. He's constantly broke, running out of money, importuning, the Coast Survey and his, send money. And he's womanizing a lot, and he's still married, but they're living apart from Zena. And he begins an affair with this Juliette, who becomes later his second wife. He comes back to the States, and he has a nervous collapse. He's physically paralyzed, apparently. In any case, and then he finds out that he's not getting the $1,200 on which he was, that was a lot of money in those days. And Eliot decides that, at that time, that the survey is too much under, that the Harvard Observatory is too much under the influence of the survey. And we're going to bring it into Harvard itself and cut the survey out. This is familiar kind of bureaucratic politics. And so after Winlock's death, there's a two-year period where there's no director, and Eliot is the de facto director. And he just screws Charlie Peirce at every turn. And because Charlie has to deal with Eliot begging for this, that, or the other thing. And so Eliot says, Charlie says, I'm out of here. And he always, by the way, disparages Eliot's intellectual caliber. Eliot kept talking about having safe men on the faculty. He personally disliked Charlie, and his friendship with his wife's family, the Fay family, also gave him additional ammunition, apparently. And thereafter, for the rest of their lives, any request to Eliot for information on Mr. Charles Sanders Peirce yielded a statement of moral outrage, apparently hot, This destroyed Charlie's life. Anyway, so during this period, he flees. He goes to New York, to Hoboken, to the Stevens Institute, to set up gravimetric researches there. And he starts talking about using diffraction gratings to measure light, and he's also very much into the bohemian life of New York now. He then learns that he's being considered for a professorship at the newly founded Johns Hopkins University, 1876, modeled after the German universities. James had recommended him to the president, Daniel Gilman. But nevertheless, Charlie says, I can't do it now because I'm going to Europe again. By now, I'm beginning to wonder whether he wants to go to Europe to party or to do science. But anyway, he runs off to Europe again. He does, talks to more people in geodesy, continues to be in Paris. Starts working more and more on the theory of errors of observation. He starts writing articles for various journals outlining his ideas on scientific method. He takes a very anti-metaphysical line. His ideas are actually taken up by the newish Vienna circle, whose positivist anti-metaphysical leanings were clear. He attends the Berlin meeting of the International Geodetic Association. He has a personal triumph. His father writes to Gilman at Hopkins on behalf of Charlie, "You're looking for a head of the Department of Physics. Consider Charlie." However, the former outgoing head of the Department of Physics is somebody who Charlie has patronized in a series of journal reviews. So Charlie gets vetoed. And Gilman writes to him back, "Your writing undervalues everybody and everything." Later, Gilman offers him a lectureship in physics. Charlie feels he's worthy only of a professorship. He wants tenure. He declines it. Then later, 6 months later, he's offered a lectureship in logic for 1 year. Charlie is absolutely desperately broke. He needs the money. He accepts. But he's going to continue to do some work for the survey. Meanwhile, he's falling behind on all these dull technical reports he's supposed to write, and he wants to write about philosophy and logic. And he maintains his extravagant lifestyle in New York. He keeps a suite at the Brevoort Hotel, continues to write articles. And he goes down to Baltimore and teaches a course in logic, and amongst his students that year are Thorstein Veblen and John Dewey. But he's always doing this on the come because Gilman has told him that he will receive tenure and that he will get a professorship.
I think he went somewhere. He finished up at Stanford and he finished up at Cambridge. He was very, very similar.
Who is this? Yeah?
But I remember somewhere he went, he was being considered for the faculty, and the president knew he was a terrible womanizer. And they brought him to a party, the faculty and faculty wives and so on, and the president came up and said to him, "Since that's my friend, Mr. Baker," he said, "we're all worried about our wives here if you come." And so he looked around the room there and he says, "You don't have to worry."
Right. I think that was at Chicago, actually, because he was on the faculty there. Anyway, in 1880, his father dies. This is his real protector. And Patterson, his father's protege, who's still protecting him at the survey, dies 3 years later. And so the two most influential protective figures in his life vanish in that 3 years. And suddenly he's out there naked. And now with the death of Patterson, this number two guy, Hilgard, becomes the superintendent of the survey. And he's never like Charlie. I mean, he's just a second rater. And, you know, Charlie knows it. And he knows that Charlie knows it and so forth. And by the way, things are so bad under the Hilgard regime at the survey that there's a congressional investigation, which, you know, shows he's a drunkard and, you know, no expense accounts, so forth. Charlie is, meanwhile, so desperate for money that he sells his library to Hopkins for $500. And he's living openly with Juliet, who, you know, he gets the divorce from Zena and he marries Juliet. And he's a shocking figure. And Juliet, a Habsburg princess who had an affair with the future Kaiser, was paid off to live in America and never come back and had a small income. That's one story. There are a half a dozen stories. Nobody seems to know. Huguenot family of some kind. And 16 years younger than Charlie, and just zero interest in science or modernity, you know, her dresses. And Charlie is deeply in love with her and very, very tender his whole life long. They're angelic together. And she has surgical operations and TB, and she's always sick. She outlives him by 20 years. But anyway, so they go to Europe again, and he cruises around. And now the downhill trajectory begins. First of all, his hope for a professorship at Hopkins, he was thinking it was permanent. He took a house in Baltimore, bought furniture. Everybody's still very shocked at Juliet. They refuse to receive her. He goes up to Boston to see his family. She's not received in Cambridge or Boston. I mean, this is, you know, the age of innocence. His mother disapproves of Juliet. There's a scandal. Anyway, it's the age of innocence story. Meanwhile, Charlie is desperate for money. He's holding two jobs, lectures at Hopkins, Coast Survey work, catching up on observatory work, bohemian life in New York, and this is where he starts to use cocaine very frequently, as a, you know, just like Freud suggested. At one point, he realizes he needs his books that he's sold to Hopkins. So he goes to the library, and he takes down about 20 of them, and he takes them back to his house. The librarian is a little disturbed. Gilman writes him some kind of note without, you know, being exquisitely sensitive to Charlie's feelings. Charlie sends back this stinging note to him. And Gilman, the president of the University of Hopkins, is deeply offended, but Charlie still assumes he'll get tenure. Then Simon Newcomb steps in. Newcomb is a guy who loved to mix politics and science in those days, and he was an observational astronomer, and he took a special interest in always finding out the worst he could about Charlie. He was a former student of Benjamin Peirce's, you know, maybe it was a kind of sibling rivalry. And he was now an astronomer at the Naval Observatory. He was also a good friend of Hilgard, the hack who was running the Coast Survey. And so he writes a letter to Gilman, cautioning him against Charlie Peirce. And he says he's a scandalous figure and that he's a broken and dissolute character. And the trustees of Hopkins learn about this. And they say, not only are we not going to give him tenure and professorship, we're going to fire him. And Gilman says, gee, you know, I feel embarrassed. Look, what we'll do is we'll fire all the instructors, and then we'll renew, you know, after a lapse of a month, everybody except him. That's the way we'll do it. And that's exactly what they do. You know, just outrageous. So he's dismissed from Hopkins. Now he's absolutely broke. His father's dead. You know, and the survey is the only work he now has, and Hilgard runs it, and Charlie is being attacked all the time. And get this, Newcomb attacks his work on the survey, and he attacks Charlie and George Cantor for thinking of infinity as a mathematical quantity. Charlie's arrogance, meanwhile, makes him few friends. He always has arguments with people who fail to credit his work. And he's turned down at the University of Chicago because of Eliot and Gilman. And he starts to work harder and harder in writing his own theories of logic out, and he has the scandal with the library there. And meanwhile, at the survey, Hilgard's drunkenness now starts to become outrageous, and there's a congressional investigation. And Congress at that time doesn't really like basic science particularly. They want results, results. Charlie, in the process, is accused. The auditors go through the system. He's accused of stealing a chronometer, a watch. And somehow, the newspapers, does this sound familiar? The newspapers start to pick it up. And Charlie is now beginning to see the harsh realities of making a living, even though he's doing some of his most brilliant work. And he's essentially studying what scientists do. And he starts to do a round of pendulum observations at the University of Michigan, at Wisconsin, at Cornell. He's so broke that he gets stranded for 2 weeks at Niagara Falls because the survey won't send him the money. And he's begging for money for the survey, and Congress is now cutting back the budget of the survey at a time when Hilgard, who doesn't like him anyway, is in charge of it. So, meanwhile, Hilgard says, look, you've got to finish your photometric research. I won't pay you another dollar until you finish the work you owe us. Well, this is the work that Charlie's been laggard on and slow for years, and it's basically, you know, he needs a computer, and it's boring, it's drudge work. He wants to do philosophy, so now he's told by the survey, not another penny. It's his only source of income until you give us this work that's due. And then the newspapers of Washington start to do stories on research in America, pendulum research in America, and how it is being managed, you know? And Washington Post calls the survey a supercilious little aristocracy of scientists. The old Benjamin Peirce survey, this is a cultural transformation, was that, you know, it was informal, very casual, everybody knew everybody, it was decentralized style, everybody had wide latitude, general instructions. This changed, like, in a 10-year period to a modern bureaucracy of accountability. You know, and Charlie was just caught up in it. Prussian ideas, Germans had just won the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, and one of the most universal things that takes place in Europe and America is, for the first time, everybody cuts beards and long hair. You know, German and Prussian theory of governance, Bismarckian state, German universities. Suddenly, this whole attitude is applied to the Coast Survey, and you know, it's not the good old boys' club any longer. And Charlie suffers again. Grover Cleveland's minions were determined to find scandals. You know. Peirce was the victim of the transition. So he's forced to resign from the survey, And now he's really a notorious figure. He's been fired from two institutions, Hopkins and the Survey, you know, plus Harvard won't have him around. And there are black marks against him wherever you look. And he's absolutely dead broke. Juliet has this little trickle of an income, just enough to keep her in dresses, apparently. And Charlie starts to borrow money from all he can. And he becomes an absolute master at the art of begging. And then his mother dies, and he gets the last single chunk of money he'll ever get in his life, and he buys a country estate, which he calls Arisbe, which is the Greek center of cosmology. And it's where New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and New York all come together. At that point, they're right on the Delaware River. And that place absolutely sinks him. And it's one of these things that just sucks money. And he has so much grief from that place. But nevertheless, he thought he was going to have a summer institute there. It's 2 hours from New York on the Erie Railway. And it's just full of high-toned Huguenots, the Pinchots. Gifford Pinchot, by the way, who was the first head of the Forest Service, says that it was Charlie Peirce who convinced him to have a career in forestry. He's convinced that land will go up and the railroad will come even closer, and it's right on the river, and it's quite beautiful. And it's described in those days, this is, of course, out of Brent's biography, in Bicyclist's guidebook as a place of good cooking because of all the French who had settled there. And it's like the Hamptons, you know, it's the stockbrokers and the painters. Al Bierstadt has a place there, publishers. All his cronies from the Century Club are out there. Charlie starts looking for patrons now, wealthy, powerful patrons for his school of logic and philosophy. He starts dreaming of sudden wealth. He commutes back and forth to New York where he has a house. And Juliet is endlessly ill. She has two major surgeries. And they live in Arisbe for the rest of their life. And today, it is a national monument maintained by the Park Service. And so having failed to breach upper, you know, academic respectability in both Baltimore and Harvard now, and Cambridge, Baltimore and Boston, Charlie makes a beeline for the great nouveau riche of New York, because, you know, New York is, you know, merchant country, it's not Brahmins. And the Harrimans and the Belmonts and the Stuyvesants. He's a very well-connected young man, of course. And he sets himself up. I don't know whether he actually has a card printed, but he's known as a consultant in practical scientific matters. Consultant in a wide variety of things. And he writes philosophy over the weekends. And he's still trying to work on his overdue work for the Survey on gravity and geodesy. And he sends him a pacifier here or there, but no money from the Survey. But he's still officially connected to them. The new superintendent of the Survey, Mendenhall, who was a former student of Simon Newcomb's, who was responsible for Peirce's dismissal from Hopkins, and with Eliot, one of those destructive figures for Peirce, Mendenhall is an efficient science administrator, and he has been given the instructions from Congress, cut the budget. And at this time, Charlie is falling further and further behind. He's now in his sort of late-ish 40s and early 50s, and his eyes begin to go bad. And, you know, the eyeglass game wasn't quite what it is today. And so he's falling further and further behind, and finally he hands in his great report, thinking, this will get me up to date, 3 years behind. And Mendenhall, the superintendent, gets the report, can't quite understand it, and he says, well, I'll send it to Simon Newcomb to get his opinion. Peer review. Newcomb's then at the Naval Observatory. Newcomb's mediocrity simply doesn't grasp what he's looking at, and he slams Peirce. Charlie's discussion on the logic of science and how you draw, you know, the whole idea of inference and what conclusions you're permitted to draw from observations, you know, is completely lost on Newcomb. Charlie's discussion of error and theories of error, and, you know, is completely lost on Newcomb. Newcomb rejects the idea of Charlie's use of logarithmic seconds. He said, it'll only confuse everybody. Only confuses the reader. He says, the Survey shouldn't publish. This is a dreadful piece of work. This is at the time when Charlie's European standing was never higher. Peirce had clearly misjudged the caliber of his audience here, and Newcomb's report was just another piece of ruin for Charlie, but this time ruining him in Washington, D.C. And finally, in 1891, Mendenhall asks him for his resignation, ending a 30-year association. Now, dig this. The guts of Peirce's report on gravity was used by a fellow named Charles Schott a few years later, and in 1899, without giving credit to Peirce, using all of his data, Schott received the Wild Prize for physics. There's a fellow named Victor Lenson, a historian of science. In 1965, he writes a book which is the definitive PhD, definitive study of 19th century pendulum research, and he examines Peirce's long report with great care, and he forcefully calls the experimental and theoretical research simply the best work of its kind in the 19th century. Anyway, within 10 years, Charlie's in involuntary exile. It's not that convenient to keep going to New York. They're so broke they can't keep the place in New York any longer. And he's becoming more and more of a recluse. He's, you know, he doesn't go to the Century Club and hang out with his cronies anymore, and he's absolutely living only by selling book reviews by the word. And he starts borrowing like mad, and the house is leaking, and fixing the roof, and he's going into debt, and there are tradesmen's liens against him. Anyway, and the merit really hits the fan, and he's also trying to keep up appearances, buying fine silk neckties, so forth. And for about a 10-year period, about 1890, 1900, there's just mad juggling going on in his life, and he's gambling. And the only paragraph of Joseph Brent's I'll read to you is about what's happening to Charlie as he's coming to the end of his life. He says, "At the end, he stands there in tatters, surrounded by the melancholy debris of his life, apologetic and contrite, asking our, and especially his dearest friend William James, indulgence. But all the while, this poor fool, behind the scenes and between the acts, has been building piece by piece the armature of a most marvelously intricate universe. So beautiful it transfigures him amidst the wreck of his afflictions, and we gratefully see the signs and system around us with new eyes." So he lives this life of a recluse out there in real poverty. When he goes to New York, sometimes he wanders around the village in the Bowery stealing food from trash. He's so hungry. Everybody's tapped out, all of his friends. James keeps sending him money and so forth. His cronies send him money, but he can't, it just runs through his pockets. And meanwhile, he's working on guessing and hypothesis forming and a grammar of hypotheses and a guess at the riddle. His whole life long, he kept talking about the riddle, the riddle, the riddle, his approaches to it. And then there are two publications which now figure strongly in his life. One is a publication called The Monist. It was a journal of philosophy published in Chicago, and the other was The Nation, which is still around in its Stalinist form right now. The Monist, Paul Karras was the editor, and he commissions 5 essays from Charlie, which he does. The Architecture of Theories, which is setting out the basis for sign action. The Doctrine of Necessity Examined, which is his attack on physical determinism. The Law of Mind, a discussion of chance and continuity, and the forms of logical inference, deduction, induction, and abduction. Man's Glassy Essence, from Measure for Measure, an application of his theories to biology, where he discusses the relationship of mind to protoplasm. Talks about emergent semantic functions, in effect. Viewing a thing from the outside, considering its relations to action and reaction with other things, it appears as matter. Viewing it from the inside, looking at its immediate character as feeling, it appears as consciousness. And then his last essay, Evolutionary Love, a Political Condemnation of the Gilded Age. He also had good relations with Wendell Phillips Garrison, who was the editor of The Nation. Long friendship. Always Garrison was in sending him money, advancing him money, and through Garrison and all the books he was asked to review, he kept up with everything in science. He was the reviewer in science, philosophy, logic, for 20 years. And the only thing he seemed to be cut off from was contact with mathematicians, and some people think this is, in a sense, why he was particularly brilliant in this area. That his isolation from mathematicians produced his theory of semiosis. He's always close to bankruptcy. For the last 25 years of his life, he's wanted for judgment in Pennsylvania and hides out in New York, fleeing creditors. He's always involved with get-rich-quick schemes. He has a lot of stockbroker buddies. He has an idea for like a micropedia, like a la Roget. He consults on the design and mathematical analysis of stress and suspension bridges for various people. He invents an electrolytic bleaching process. He has a design for cheap lighting from acetylene gas. He has all these theories of hydroelectric generation. And he's just wandering through the New York underworld sometimes. At the same time, he's a disheveled figure. He's in Hell's Kitchen stealing food. Juliet is out in Arisbe. In 1898, James, really taking great pity on him and thinking he's a true genius and unknown, invites him to come to Harvard, to Cambridge, to give a series of lectures on logic and the reasoning of things, eight lectures. Eliot will not have him on campus. James hires a hall. Charlie comes, you know, he's talking about the laws of thought. You know, he gives his 8 lectures. Irony, today you can buy the lectures, Harvard University Press, with an introduction by Hillary Putnam. You know, so everything, what goes around, comes around. So, now, okay, and he always puts out feelers for academic employment, Stanford, Columbia. He once accused Nicholas Murray Butler of plagiarism. You know, that didn't help him. You know, Clark University, Cornell, Madison, Chicago, Worcester Polytech, all invariably shot down by Newcomb and Eliot. James tries to arrange lectures on cosmology at Harvard because he was an astronomer. Eliot refuses again to have him on campus. And a few rich capitalists, George Plimpton's, the current George Plimpton's grandfather, George Plimpton, you know, sends him a check regularly. Gifford, the elder Pinchot, sends him checks routinely. James, when he can afford it, sends him, you know, $50, something like that. Charlie writes articles, sometimes for popular journals, Our Senses as Reasoning Machines in Cosmopolitan. And once he's even a sales rep for a publisher. In 1902, one of his last great stab at respectability, the newly created Carnegie Institution, Charlie is encouraged by James and a few others to apply for a grant to complete his summa on the logic of science, to outline his entire system. And he writes a grant proposal, which is, you know, one of the gems of the Peirce archive. It's online, by the way. It's his summary of everything. And again, Eliot, Gilman, and Newcomb shoot him down. This is interesting. His grant is before Carnegie. In support of his application, he has letters from Theodore Roosevelt, you know, Elihu Root, who was then Secretary of State, Henry Cabot Lodge, his cousin, you know. Nothing helped. He was considered morally degenerate, mentally unstable, arrogant, irresponsible, and a man of dissolute character. The trustees said no. In 1903, Charlie's now 64. James literally forced Eliot to relent, and Charlie gave a lecture series in Seaver Hall, Harvard. Santayana attended, discussed how knowledge as experience is possible at all. How does nature enter into logical discourse? 1909, age 70, has cancer. I don't know what kind. Can't sell the house. You know, just lays there in bed in the cold. He can't heat the house. His brother, who's in the Foreign Service, is trying to get Charlie a job as the consul, American consul in Ceylon. In Colombo. Doesn't work. His few friends send him a regular check. He dies in 1914, Juliet in 1934. Hosiah Royce saves his papers for Harvard. So that's the end of the story. What does one see? First of all, a polymath, a system-building theorist. In mathematics, he's apparently always going to be remembered for his contributions to linear algebra. In surveying, for his cross-continental triangulation to determine the Earth's ellipticity. In philology, apparently, for his contributions to the pronunciation of Elizabethan English. In cryptography, for his model of the Enigma coding device, which he offered to sell to his cousin Henry Cabot Lodge. In logic, for his algebra of logic, his quantitative theory, his logic of relations, his theory of errors, his three-valued logic, his logical graphs. In computer science, for the first known sketch of the design and theory of an electric switching circuit computer, which he put in quotes. In astronomy, for his discoveries relating to the shape of our galaxy. In philosophy, for his evolutionary epistemology of chance and continuity, where mind is embodied in the world as a system of relations represented by signs. For Peirce, the pursuit of knowledge, especially science, was not an individual matter. It was a social praxis, a community of inquirers. I recommend them to you. Yeah. There's one paper that is in the library here, which is, I think, delicious, because there are problems in theory of languages and programming, I think, by this woman, Claudine Tiercelin. She is professor of the Department of Philosophy at the Sorbonne, and this paper is on Peirce's logic of vagueness. It's very interesting. This is a direct, you know, attack on what do you do when, you know, what you're observing is vague, uncertain, indeterminate. And, you know, it's just really high. And, it, you know, she's explaining his theories. It's exciting. It's Claudine Engel-Tiercelin. I'll show it to you. And then there's a fellow named Michael Brady. Do you know him? This is and I make copies of this for anybody who wants it. Epistemology from an evolutionary point of view. You know, this evolutionary epistemology is now Charlie's field, apparently. And then Elliot Sober, you know, is a cult, his models of cultural evolution, which sort of, you know. Models of cultural evolution. You just make Xeroxes of anything you want here.
What's the reference on abduction?
Abduction is one of those themes that is a lifelong preoccupation for him. So I think the first time it's stated clearly is in his New Categories. I would suggest that the book to read, and you know, I mean, how about an abductive approach to the bar problem would be interesting. You know, somebody's good guessing. Now, what makes a good guesser? What's he doing? I would actually start with some of the secondary sources. I mean, you'll get to the heart of the matter more quickly. But you can look at New Categories, and I can think of several, you know, several of his essays in The Monist, and until he's fairly recently, all of his, he's been, by the way, there was a, the Paul Weiss at Yale did the standard 8 volumes, which is what is in print. That's now considered ancient. They're completely redoing it at Indiana. There's going to be a 20-volume, you know, Verka on Peirce coming out in a bit. But with, you know, the key to Peirce is indexing. How do you find, because he keeps, you know, modifying and changing, growing and evolving his theories. But there's a wonderful book by Umberto Eco, the Italian semiologist, and Thomas Sebeok, America's greatest semiotician, called, interestingly enough, The Sign of Three. You know, Peirce was just, this is in fact his metaphysics is about three. That three is an engine, two is not. And so this book called Peirce, Holmes, and Poe. And in Sherlock Holmes and in the detective stories of Edgar Allan Poe, you have detectives, and Sebeok and Eco are showing you that what makes these guys so great is their abductive skills. And the more you're exposed to the theories of abduction, you think, well, you know, it's got to be three-legged with induction. I mean, it's a different animal. It's a different taxa. And, you know, it's the idea of hypothetical reasoning, that you're reasoning backward from a hypothesis. And it's always imperfect. It never, you know, it's just a community asymptotic affair. It just, you know. But, look at that Eco book. The Sign of Three is a good introduction to abduction. You know, an easy read, in other words. I mean, you do it through Peirce, you just got to sit there and grind and remember how to stack the dependent clauses, basically. And, you know, it gets fatiguing. I think he is, as Prigozhin says, in his anticipations and I think you're, you know, I mean, I think he would be just exquisitely overjoyed to see what you're doing here. I think the one area that you're not touching is the theory of signs. I mean, how, you know, representations. I mean, the focus is very strongly on dynamics here. You know. Yes. Well, so does Chomsky, you know. Because, you see, his logic is generative. It's transformational logic. It's churning, and it's just, you know, and it somehow it sums over appropriately. Anyway, he's clearly a great mind, and, you know, would have been a gas to know. Okay. Very well.